Okay, now I'm ready to start. Okay, so like I said, this is going to be about the death of Kurt Cobain, and it is one of the only conspiracy theories that I really fully believe in, that he did not kill himself, and I'll explain why. I'm gonna get started with a little bit of his early life leading up to his band Nirvana and leading up to his suicide. So, Kurt Donald Cobain was born on February 20th, 1967, in Aberdeen, Washington, to waitress Wendy Elizabeth and car mechanic Donald Leland Cobain. Kurt wasn't the only musician in the family. His uncle Chuck Fradenberg, on his mother's side, was in a band called the Beachcombers. His aunt Mary Earle played guitar in multiple bands throughout Grays Harbor County. And his great uncle Delbert was an Irish tenor and made an appearance in the 1930 film King of Jazz. Kurt was described as a happy but sensitive child with great artistic talent. His grandmother encouraged his drawing as she was a professional artist. Kurt began singing at the age of two, and then by the age of four, he was singing and learning how to play the piano. When Kurt was 9 years old, his parents divorced, at which point Kurt became withdrawn and defiant, according to his mother. In an interview in 1993, just 1 year before his death, Kurt said, "I remember feeling ashamed for some reason. I was ashamed of my parents. I couldn't face some of my friends at school anymore because I desperately wanted to have the classic, you know, typical family. Mother, father, I wanted that security, so I resented my parents for quite a few years because of that." At the time of their divorce, his parents only had Kurt and his younger sister Kimberly, who was born April 24th, 1970. Kurt's father promised that he would never remarry, but ended up meeting and marrying Jenny Westaby. Jenny had two children of her own, Mandy and James. Mindy and James, sorry. Kurt, Donald, Jenny, and her children moved into a new home together, and originally Kurt really liked Jenny as she gave him the attention that he really needed. But in January of 1979, Jenny gave birth to his half-brother Chad, which ultimately took her attention away from Kurt. On June 28th, 1979, Kurt's mother granted full custody of Kurt to his father, Donald, after Kurt witnessed Wendy being beat on by her boyfriend. Kurt began to act out, and quickly Donald became overwhelmed. As a result, he moved Kurt in with his friends, whose dad happened to also be his school principal. That man's name was Lamont Schellinger. Lamont and his family were devout Christians. And as a result, Kurt became one too. For some reason or another, though, Kurt ended up becoming a staunch atheist, often being outspoken about his disdain for Christianity. His song Lithium was actually written about Lamont and his religion. In school, Kurt became friends with another male student who happened to be gay. The other students quickly spread around the school that Kurt was also gay just for being friends with this guy. Even though he wasn't gay, Kurt liked that rumor went around because it meant that the other kids would leave him alone. In one of his personal journals, Kurt wrote, "I'm not gay, although I wish I were, just to piss off the homophobes." In early July 1990, Kurt began dating Bikini Kill member Toby Vail. They would often sing together on her dad's four-track machine. Once, while hanging out with Bikini Kill singer Catherine Hanna, talking about anarchism and punk music, Catherine spray painted Kurt Smells Like Teen Spirit on his apartment wall. Teen Spirit was the name of the deodorant that Toby would wear, but Kurt didn't know this. He thought that this had some kind of revolutionary meaning to it, and so he wrote the song Smells Like Teen Spirit. Funny little tidbit about Catherine Hanna and Bikini Kill. During one of the Lollapalooza music festivals that Kurt's wife Courtney was at, Bikini Kill was supposed to go on stage, and that's how he came up with the song. She had some kind of snafu backstage with Catherine Hanna, and somehow a punch was thrown, and like it was a huge drama fest. My friend Katie was actually there and witnessed it. She was friends with the guy that hosted Lollapalooza. So she got to see the whole thing with her own eyes. So that's why I bring that up, because I did not know until I was doing these notes that Kurt and Catherine were friends. So in early 1985, Kurt formed the band Fecal Matter with Dave Crover. But in 1986, the band dissolved, with Dave creating the band The Melvins. While hanging out with Dave, though, Kurt met Krist Novoselic. It's a hard name to pronounce. He basically kept hounding this guy for months on end to create a band with him. And finally, the pair were able to form that band. They had a bunch of different names. There were like five different names before they finally settled on Nirvana. But at that time, Kurt was becoming interested in Judaism and Buddhism, and that's where he got the name Nirvana from. It has something to do with the Buddhist religion. Eventually, the band hired Chad Channing as a drummer, creating the album Bleach in 1989. That is their first major album that was put out. But after a falling out with Chad, they then hired Dave Grohl, which, funny story, after Kurt's death, Dave Grohl went on to create the band The Foo Fighters. He's actually the lead singer of The Foo Fighters. In 1991, that group, Kurt's band with Dave Grohl, the group released their hit album Nevermind with the song Smells Like Teen Spirit on it. That's the album that has the cover with the naked baby on it. That's pretty much what that album's known for. As a vocal opponent to sexism, racism, and homophobia, the band proudly played at the gay rights rally benefit No to Nine in 1992 to protest the ballot bill in Oregon law that was basically to teach in schools that homosexuality was an abomination and wrong. Kurt met Courtney Love on January 12th, 1990 in a club in Portland. She was the lead singer of the grunge band Hole. She wasn't very popular, as far as I'm aware. I never actually heard a single one of her songs, and I was really into grunge in high school. Courtney was, like, super obsessed with him, though. Like, she was really smitten with him, and she was constantly trying to pursue him. But for months, he kept constantly breaking dates with her, because he had just gotten out of a relationship with Toby Vail, and so he wanted to be single for a few months. But in an interview, he said, "I knew I liked Courtney right away. That was a real struggle to stay away from her for so many months." In late 1991, the pair were often together and bonded through their mutual drug use. On February 24th, 1992, the pair were married in Hawaii with eight people present. Courtney wore a lace and satin dress while Kurt wore green pajama pants because, according to him, I was too lazy to put on a tux. Courtney has since said that she loved the fact that he didn't wear a tux and wore his pajamas, because that was who she had fallen in love with. You know, who he was as a person. Which, I don't believe a word out of that woman's mouth, but just saying. Courtney, at this time, though, was pregnant with their daughter, Frances Bean, during the ceremony, with Courtney giving birth on August 11th, 1992. Her sonogram was actually used in the artwork for their song Lithium. During a Vanity Fair interview, while pregnant with Frances, Courtney stated that she had used heroin before she knew that she was pregnant, and this pretty much put the Department of Child Services on their ass, and the LA County Department of Children's Services actually took them to court for it. But Courtney was able to say that, you know, "I quit using, so we're still fit parents." Let's see here. Oh, she also said that she had been misquoted in the interview, sorry. Throughout Kurt's life, he had chronic pain from an undiagnosed stomach condition, which I have since learned was IBS and chronic bronchitis. As a result, Kurt began using marijuana at the ripe old age of 13 years old. He continued to use marijuana throughout his adult life, but gradually increased to harder drugs such as LSD and heroin, as most everybody knows. He began using heroin in 1986, but it was sporadic for quite a while until the end of 1990. Yeah, until the end of 1990. He said that he noticed his stomach pain went away when he was using heroin, so he just kept using it every single day. I know since then, Dave Grohl has come forward and said that that was not true. He did not have a stomach condition. That whole thing came out after people kept asking him about the heroin abuse. He said it was basically just a cop-out for him to be able to use heroin whenever he wanted. It was his excuse. Prior to a show at the New Music Seminar in New York City in July 1993, Kurt overdosed. Instead of calling 911 like she should have, Courtney ended up giving him Narcan instead, and he went and performed that night as if nothing ever happened. On March 1st, 1994, Kurt asked his lawyer, Rosemary Carroll, to remove Courtney's name from his will as he was planning to file for divorce. Kurt's first suicide attempt happened on March 4th, 1994, just 3 days later. Due to a severe case of laryngitis and bronchitis, Kurt flew to Rome for treatment with Courtney. But on the morning of March 4th, Courtney awoke to find Kurt had OD'd on rohypnol and champagne. Kurt was rushed to the hospital and remained unconscious for 24 hours and then was released 5 days later to go back home to Seattle. Courtney has since come out and said that he was trying to kill himself and that he left her a suicide note and he had 60 rohypnol pills in his stomach. But the private investigator that Courtney hired to find Kurt after he disappeared has called, actually, the Rome doctor that was treating Kurt. And the doctor has since said, no, it was not on purpose. There were not 60 pills in his system, and it was an accidental overdose. So I feel like that's kind of setting the stage to how this is going to play out. There we go. So, on March 18th, 1994, Courtney then, this is back in Seattle at their home on Lake Washington. Courtney called the police to say that Kurt was suicidal and locked himself in his room with his guns. When police arrived, Kurt said that he wasn't suicidal. He had just locked himself in their room where the guns were kept to get away from Courtney. But as a result, the police removed all of the firearms in the house. On March 25th, 1994, Courtney set up an intervention with Kurt. 10 people were present, including his best friend, Dylan Carlson. By the end of the day, Kurt agreed to enter treatment at the Exodus Treatment Center in LA. Kurt entered this program on March 30th, 1994. The next day, one of their nannies, it's not really their nanny, it was their nanny's girlfriend. She brought Frances to the treatment center and Kurt spent the entire day playing with her. That day, Courtney called the treatment center 13 times, threatening the staff because Kurt was refusing to answer her phone calls. On April 1st, 1994, Kurt climbed a 6-foot-tall fence surrounding the treatment center, got in a cab, and flew back to Seattle. On April 3rd, Courtney, seeing that Kurt had purchased airline tickets in their bank account, she hired private investigator Tom Grant to find Kurt. So Tom Grant has since put out this documentary that I watched this week called Soaked in Bleach, which I actually just found out that the title of that song came from, I wrote it down. There was a song that Kurt had sung If I could find what I did with it. I know I wrote it down. Maybe I didn't. Oh, it was Come As You Are. One of the lines in that song is actually soaked in bleach. So I had no idea that's where the title of the documentary came from. It's a dramatization of interviews from Tom Grant and Dylan Carlson, basically the entire investigation. He has been investigated heavily, Tom Grant, because a lot of private investigators have really shady pasts. And oddly enough, this guy is squeaky clean. He's very credible. He's a very credible private investigator. So very early on, he saw red flags and began recording every single conversation that he had with Courtney. Tom met her at the Peninsula Hotel later that day, April 3rd. Not only did Courtney answer the door in nothing but see-through negligee, but the very first words out of her mouth to Tom were, "If you leak a word of this, I'll sue the fuck out of you." Every time she talked about Kurt to Tom, it was nothing but belittling Kurt, calling him pathetic and how he's so pathetic he can't even catch a cab by himself. Just really, really cruel things to say. She also informed him at that meeting that Kurt was suicidal and had bought a shotgun, which really shocked Tom because isn't that something that you would say at the beginning? Like, not wait for the guy to show up and then later on in the conversation be like, "Oh, by the way, my husband's suicidal and I think he's going to shoot himself with the shotgun that he bought." I think that's a really big detail that has to be kind of talked about. It just lacks empathy all around. On April 4th, Courtney informed Tom that she had leaked to the public that she had been admitted to the hospital for an attempted suicide through OD in an effort to get Kurt to call her and to help boost record sales for her new album that was about to be released. Even though she wasn't in the hospital, she never OD'd or anything like that, she leaked it for the publicity and to manipulate Kurt. She also let him know how furious she was because at the time, Kurt was supposed to be headlining Lollapalooza. At the very last minute, he decided to back out of the performance. And by doing that, it kind of took away the opportunity for Hole to perform as well. And she felt that really was like, it screwed her over because that was money that her band could have been making if Kurt wasn't so selfish that he took that opportunity away from me, is basically how she had presented that whole situation. But yet at the same meeting, she cried to Tom saying that Kurt had left her a letter saying that he was going to file for divorce. But if he thought he was going to get custody of Francis, he had another thing coming. She'd get custody of her in a heartbeat. Even though at this time that Kurt was in rehab and she was in LA supposedly for business, Francis was still in Seattle with their male nanny. And her nanny was not just her male nanny, but also her ex-boyfriend that she was leaving her daughter with. And that just really skeeves me out. I know it's just as a parent of a little girl, like, nah, not my, no. The whole situation really irks me. But she also believed that Kurt was not only cheating on her with his drug dealer, but possibly with her lead guitarist in her band. She, that same day, had put out a missing persons report on Kurt under his mother's name, so that way it wouldn't be tied back to her. She also said that he may be using the aliases Simon Ritchie and Bill Bailey, and would probably be staying in a fancy hotel because Kurt hated dive motels. Kurt's own friend, Dylan Carlson, later on actually told Tom that that's not true. He hates fancy hotels. He only likes to stay in the dive motels. So at that point, Tom flew to Seattle to find him. He did find that a man named Bill Bailey may have been staying in a seedy motel in Seattle, but when he called Courtney to see if it would be okay if he reached out and verified that it was Kurt, Courtney basically told him no, that she didn't want Kurt to know that she had hired a private investigator to find him. He then informed her that he wanted to watch their Lake Washington house in case Kurt, you know, showed up at the house. But Courtney vehemently denied that, saying that her ex-boyfriend, Callie DeWitt, was staying at the house with the baby. That's just another huge red flag for me. That the fact that she would not allow him to go to the house. So on April 6th, 1994, Tom was finally able to convince Courtney to let him check out the house to see if the shotgun was still there. She only agreed on the stipulation that Dylan Carlson go with. When he met with Dylan, the young man informed Tom that the OD in Rome wasn't a suicide attempt, but an accident. You know, like I said, it was later confirmed that it was an accident. Dylan also told Tom that the shotgun was registered in his name because when the police came and they removed the weapons, shortly after that, their home had been broken into and, Kurt wanted something to protect the house. And so Dylan was like, I'll get a gun for you. Courtney had told Tom that Kurt's song lyrics also proved just how depressed he was, but in interviews, Kurt has said that they weren't about his feelings, but the intense stomach pain that he had, but that since he had started taking the proper meds, that he was the happiest that he had ever been, and that was shortly before his death that he said that. So Tom and Dylan climbed through the window in the middle of the night to see if Kurt was there and to find the shotgun. They tore the master bedroom apart looking for where Courtney said the gun would be, including taking the bed completely apart. They took all of the bedding off. They threw the mattress off, seeing if maybe it was stuck underneath the wet, you know, in between the box spring and the mattress. And they didn't find anything. The only thing that they did find were Rohypnol pills. But when Tom called Courtney to tell her that he couldn't find the gun and call her out on the lie about Kurt's attempted suicide in Rome, she told him that she knew it was an attempted suicide because Kurt left a suicide note, but she didn't have it anymore because the detectives in Rome told her to destroy it. On April 7th, Tom and Dylan went back to the Lake Washington home after being told that there was a secret compartment in the closet where the gun was supposed to be kept. They didn't find the gun. The secret compartment was empty, but they did find a letter written to Kurt from Callie, and I'm going to read to you what the letter said. "Kurt, I can't believe you managed to be in this house without me noticing. You're an asshole for not calling Courtney and at least letting her know you're okay. She's in a lot of pain, Kurt, and this morning she had another accident, in quotations, and is now in the hospital again. She's your wife and she loves you and you have a child together. Get it together to at least let her know you're okay or she is going to die. It's not fair, man. Do something now." When later showed to Kurt and Courtney's attorney, Rosemary Carroll, she believed that Callie wrote that letter knowing that Kurt was dead. And another thing too was after the first time they went to the house, I didn't write it in my notes, but after the first time they went to the house and they couldn't find the shotgun, Courtney did tell Tom that Callie found a letter on her bed from Kurt stating that it was a suicide that he was committing suicide. And Tom flat out called her out on it. He was like, that's not true. That letter doesn't exist because I tore that bed apart. She was like, no, it was under the pillows. And he goes, I tore the pillows off the bed. I tore the mattress off the bed. That letter was not there. Plain and simple. Kurt did not write you this letter. So further proof that she's trying to skew this narrative, you know. On April 8th, 1994, an electrician went to the Lake Washington home to do some work in the space above the garage that they called the greenhouse. Through the double glass doors, he could see the body of Kurt laying in a large pool of blood with the shotgun in his hand. A suicide note was found next to his body. And I'm going to read that to you now. To Boda. Speaking from the tongue of an experienced simpleton who obviously would rather be an emasculated, infantile complainee, this note should be pretty easy to understand. All of the warnings from the punk rock 101 courses over the years, since my first introduction to the, shall we say, ethics involved with independence and the embrace of your community, has proven to be very true. I haven't felt the excitement of listening to, as well as creating music along with reading and writing, for too many years now. I feel guilty beyond words about these things. For example, when we're backstage and the lights go out and the manic roar of the crowds begin, it doesn't affect me the way it did for Freddie Mercury, who seemed to love, relish in the love, and adoration from the crowd, which is something I totally admire and envy. The fact is, I can't fool you, any one of you. It isn't fair to you or me. The worst crime I can think of would be to rip people off by faking it and pretending as if I'm 100% fun. Sometimes I feel as if I should have a punch-in time clock before I walk out on stage. I've tried everything within my power to appreciate it, and I do, God, believe me, I do, but it's not enough. I appreciate the fact that I and we have affected and entertained a lot of people. It must be one of those narcissists who only appreciate things when they're gone. I'm too sensitive. I need to be slightly numb in order to regain the enthusiasms I once had as a child. Our last three tours, I've had a much better appreciation for all the people I've known personally and as fans of our music, but I still can't get over the frustration, the guilt, and empathy I have for everyone. There's good in all of us, and I think I simply love people too much, so much that it makes me feel too fucking sad. The sad little, sensitive, unappreciative Pisces Jesus man. Why don't you just enjoy it? I don't know. I have a goddess of a wife who sweats ambition and empathy, and a daughter who reminds me too much of what I used to be, full of love and joy, kissing every person she meets because everyone is good and will do her no harm. And that terrifies me to the point where I can barely function. I can't stand the thought of Francis becoming the miserable, self-destructive death rocker that I have become. I have it good, very good, and I'm grateful, but since the age of 7, I've become hateful towards all humans in general, only because it seems so easy for people to get along with that have empathy, only because I love and feel sorry for people too much, I guess. Thank you all from the pit of my burning, nauseous stomach for your letters and concerns during the past years. I'm too much of an erratic, moody baby. I don't have the passion anymore, and so remember, it's better to burn out than to fade away. Peace, love, empathy, Kurt Cobain. Francis and Courtney, I'll be at your altar. Please keep going, Courtney, for Francis. For her love, I will be so much happier, For her life, which will be so much happier without me. I love you. I love you. So I do have pictures of the suicide note that I can share. I think it's really important that I show you guys because it's, you'll understand what I'm saying when I say that I really do not think that Kurt wrote that, because the writing is just, it's hard to explain. Let me see here. Share screen. Okay, so can you guys see this? So this is what I mean. If you look The writing in through here is much different than the last four lines of his supposed suicide letter. Can't see the screen. Oh, wait, chair. There we go. Okay. I don't know what that's doing, but can you guys see this? Okay, so right in here, you can see that the writing is very different compared to the last four sentences on the paper. And it's been later said that, switch to camera. There we go. Rosemary DeWitt, the attorney, their lawyer, sorry, I had a moment. So their lawyer has since said that when she finally saw the letter, she did not think that Kurt wrote that. And we'll get into that here in just a few minutes. So what Tom wanted to know when all of this came out was why Dylan Carlson didn't mention the greenhouse. He tried speaking with the Seattle Police Department who were on the scene, but was completely shocked when they said that they didn't want to speak with him, even though he told them that he was in the home that night before. And not only that, but instead of actually investigating the death, they immediately ruled it a suicide. And they signed the death certificate that day, which completely boggles my mind. There were so many red flags surrounding the crime scene, too. First, you know, it was reported that a stool was blocking the double glass doors, even though from the photos, which, by the way, were not even developed until 2014. But according to those photos, the stool was on the complete other side of the room. It wasn't anywhere near the double glass doors. They also said that the door was locked so they couldn't get in. It was just one of those tiny little twist doorknob locks. It was later found out that Kurt had 1.52 milligrams per liter of heroin in his system, which equates to three times the lethal amount of heroin. There's no way that he could have shot up, cleaned himself up, cleaned up his little heroin stash because it was all in a little box next to his body, put his supplies away, lifted a shotgun, and then shoot himself in the head. And even with his high tolerance to heroin, there's physically no way. He would have been dead long before that happened. So I think the heroin was put into his system after they killed him. Or he was shot last. One or the other. They have, doctors have tried to rule this, tried to basically say, oh no, it's, he could have easily killed himself, shooting himself after dosing up that much. And a French doctor actually did a case study on it where he had a heroin addict take the equivalent of that in methadone and hop up and down and showed that he could function. But the problem with that was methadone is completely taken orally, which is a completely different metabolization. When you inject heroin, it's an immediate high. Whereas with ingestion, it takes a lot longer. It's a slower high. So again, he still would have been incapacitated. And at the same time too, methadone and heroin are not the same thing. It's like comparing apples to oranges. Heroin is completely different from methadone. Methadone is used to treat the overdose addictions of heroin. So for a doctor to sit there and say, oh, well, this guy did it on methadone, he could have done it on heroin, is completely not even, it just boggles my mind. It blew my mind when I heard that, because as a medical professional, he should know the difference. The other thing, too, was that the shotgun was found on, so he was lying on his back with the shotgun gripped in his left hand. The trigger was facing up, so what he had done was he had stuck it in his, was holding it with his left hand and used his thumb to pull the trigger. And the thing with that is where the chamber is for the shotgun shells was to the right. So when the gun went off, the shell for the shotgun should have gone out to the right. But yet, they found it on his left side. The only way that could have happened was if the gun had somehow twisted after he had shot it. But he had the death grip. That was one thing that was very heavily talked about in the documentary Soaked in Bleach was the death grip. He died and his muscles immediately clenched on it. There was no way for it to spin in his hand. The only other way for that shell to have hit his left side was for it to bounce off something that was on his right side, but there was nothing on his right side. Everything, his heroin kit, his driver's license, the suicide note, everything was on his left side. So that's another thing that was never investigated. It's crazy. 6 days after Kurt's death, the Seattle Police Department allowed Kurt to be cremated. So they didn't perform an autopsy or anything like that on him. They just immediately allowed him to be cremated. And then 30 days later, the Seattle Police Department finally processed the shotgun for fingerprints before returning it to Courtney to be melted down. Courtney claimed that there were things in the suicide note that claimed that the suicide note said things that it actually did not say in it. I'm not entirely sure what. I did not have enough time to dive that deep into it. But that was one thing that Tom Grant had said about when he had talked with Rosemary Carroll, the attorney. After Kurt's death, Tom sat down with Courtney again to talk with her. He ended up finding a piece of paper in her backpack that looked to be a practice sheet of Kurt's handwriting. He did convince her to let him take the suicide note to make a copy of it. He told her that he forgot his glasses, his reading glasses at home. Is it okay if I take this to go get copied so I can read it when I go home? So she said yes. At this point, she was denying their attorney any chance to read it. Like, she had not read it at all. Courtney flat out denied it to her. But she was dumb and she let Tom make a copy of it, and he immediately went to Carol and showed it to her. Or Rosemary Carroll. She has said that it is very clear that this is a forgery. It was not actually Kurt's legitimate handwriting. It was definitely a forgery. It was very spliced together from different sources. And the first half of the letter is mainly about his music. A suicide letter is mainly going to say things like, "My family don't deserve me. I am better off dead. My family's better off if I'm not here. I love you. I'm sorry." Basically, the last four lines of his letter were a true suicide note. Everything else in it pointed more towards his regret with his music. And if somebody, with somebody who is so sensitive and empathetic as Kurt, his family was his life. He would have written a lot more about his daughter if he were truly going to kill himself. And that is something that Rosemary has said herself. So Tom did ask to speak with Dylan again because, like I said, he wanted to know everything. He wanted to know what happened with Kurt. He wanted to know why Dylan didn't take him to this greenhouse when they were at the house two times, didn't even mention it to him. And one thing that people pointed out with that whole situation is, well, how did you not see it? You went to this house twice. How did you not see the greenhouse? And it's because it was completely surrounded by trees. It was raining and it was dark. They were going in the middle of the night. It's very easy to miss during the daylight. It's even easier to miss at night. So Courtney said that she would set him up with a meeting with Dylan, but when he got there, Courtney and Dylan came downstairs, and it was very obvious that Dylan had just shot up. He was completely incoherent. He couldn't string along more than a few seconds of a couple of words, in a sentence before starting to pass out, which really angered Tom because he's like, I am trying to figure out what happened here. I'm trying to figure out to what happened to your supposed friend. Why are you shooting up knowing that I'm coming over to talk to you? But Courtney wasn't shut up. And she thought it was really funny. And that was when he realized that, you know, Dylan relied heavily on Kurt to get his heroin. Kurt was essentially his drug dealer. He could get drugs for free from Kurt. Now that Kurt was gone, Courtney was now the one person that he could get all of his drugs from. So he now all of a sudden has this loyalty to her. So that was really frustrating. And at that point, Tom basically told him, I'm investigating you. I'm going to continue this investigation. If I find anything, I'm going to report on it. I don't care if it shows that you killed him. I don't care. I'm going to report it because that's my job. And so they had agreed to meet in LA on April 17th for her to give him the Emmy's report about the toxicology report and everything. But she never showed up. He has not seen from her since. I wholeheartedly believe that Courtney killed Kurt because it's too coincidental. She set this whole thing up by putting out that missing persons report saying that Kurt was suicidal and had a shotgun and he was missing. It basically set the stage for everything. You know, if he divorced her, they had a prenuptial agreement where if they were to get divorced, she would get hardly anything. Hole was not a very big band. Like I said at the very beginning, I've never even heard of any of their songs. And I was deep into grunge in high school. Like, I was deep into it. My mom could tell you. but killing Kurt before he filed for divorce has allowed her to inherit up to billions of dollars in royalties. And she would not have had that money if Kurt had divorced her. Not only, you know, it's really frustrating because he had a full life ahead of him. He had some problems. That's not a secret. But she not only took his life away, but she took her daughter's father away. How can you love somebody, say you love somebody, and then take them from your child that supposedly you love so much? It just boggles my mind how people can just be like that. It makes me sick. It makes me really sick. I did Google today. Frances Bean is a year younger than me. She was born in 92. So she'll be 27. No, she'll be 28 in August. I think that's right. I think I'm turning 29. I don't remember my age. But she herself has had a bad problems with drugs and alcohol, you know, since everything. And it's not surprising seeing how her mother is. But Courtney, she just received some kind of music award in February of this year. And she said during her acceptance speech that she was 18 months sober and everything, but her mannerisms were not. They're not a person that's sober. Flopping your hair all over the place and like fidgeting. She very obviously was not sober. I don't think she's ever going to be sober. It's only a matter of time before she overdoses. She has said that she got into Oxycontin. So it's only a matter of time. But Frances Bean, you know, she's doing a lot better. She's in a 12-step program. Keeps to herself, you know. She said, the one quote that sticks with me with her as an adult is, my mother and I are addicts, but we're very different addicts. I like to stay to myself. When I was using, I stayed home. I didn't go around people. I just stayed by myself. My mother is loud. She is a loud addict. She's in your face. She says vulgar things. And I'm not that. So it's just crazy. It's just crazy to see how different she's become compared to her mother. She reminds me very much of her father. And she looks a lot like Kurt as well. But Yeah, that's it. I'm out of my notes are done. I'm out of stuff to talk about. Oh, thanks, Mom. I'll be 29. But yeah. All right, so that is the case of Kurt Cobain. If you guys can go and like the Facebook page and the Instagram and the Twitter, that would be great. Make sure to join me every Thursday, sorry, at 7 p.m. at getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. It's a wonderful place for podcasters to live stream, basically live episodes. Tons of really good podcasters on there in the lineup. And if you guys could just come and see me on Get Vocal every Thursday, show your support, that'd be awesome. Thank you so much and have a great night, guys.